When are mergers in a country's rather than the company's interest?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From APM in New York, I'm David Brancaccio with a global perspective on business and economics this hour. A British developer of medicines for rare diseases is signaling it likes an offer and is ready to merge with AbbVie of Chicago. AbbVie used to be part of Abbott Labs and has been repeatedly trying to win the affections of Shire, but until now the money hasn't been enough. The $53 billion deal would move AbbVie's tax home to Britain at a time when governments are increasingly examining corporate mergers and acquisitions through the lens of whether they are in the national interest. For instance, the British government was very concerned when Pfizer of the U.S. tried to buy a research and development powerhouse in Britain, AstraZeneca. The equivalent of Britain's Commerce Secretary, Vince Cable, told the BBC his government is considering a review board to watch over mergers.
There will be cases, and this was one, where there are vital national interests. In this case, large-scale investment of R&D. The question is how you protect it. What the government did then was to engage in negotiations to seek assurances. And I think where we now have to strengthen that is to make sure that any commitments made, there's no wiggle room. And we're talking to take over a panel about how to do that, and we may well get into the area of having financial penalties in order to make sure that those commitments are binding.
Now, traditionally, governments in Britain and the U.S. and beyond use antitrust law to review mergers based mainly on whether or not they help or hurt competition. Now, let's do the numbers. The 100-share index in London is up 0.6%. The Hang Seng in Hong Kong went up 0.5%. Dow, S&P, and NASDAQ futures are up. Today, Marketplace's Sustainability Desk kicks off a series we call We Used to Be China. Our reporters are digging not only into China's air pollution crisis, but looking back at our own. And one thread we found running through the fight for clean air here in the U.S. is the organizing power of women. Sarah Gardner has the story.
Karen Lynn Madoff was just a little girl when her mom became a clean air activist. It was Pittsburgh in the late 1960s, and the air was terrible. Michelle Madoff, wife of a local heart surgeon, decided to do something about it.
She started hosting meetings in our living room.
Madoff and her neighbors, many of them women, formed a new citizens group called GASP, Group Against Smog and Pollution.
My mom said she went into the kitchen to get more drinks for people who were in the living room, and that's when they voted her president of GASP.
Madoff's mom may not have realized it then, but she was taking up the same cause women had fought for at the turn of the century when society ladies helped launch an anti-smoke movement in cities choking on coal smoke and soot. Historian David Stradling says those women didn't even have the right to vote. But back then,
it's difficult to be terribly critical of the wife of a well-connected man. There are lots of people who have become critical of women, however, when they begin to suggest specific solutions to the problem.
Even women protesting air pollution in the 1950s were chastised for that. So women sometimes played the gender card. Housewives dragged their kids to anti-smog marches. In Pasadena, California, there was a group called the Smogateers, a spoof on Disney's Mouseketeers. Historian Nancy Unger.
And there they are dressed up like, you know, in their little June Cleaver, you know, the pearls and the dress and so forth, wearing gas masks.
And more domestic props.
They've got brooms and they've got signs reading, "We want a clean sweep of smog."
Jeff Slade's mother was a leader in Stamp Out Smog, a women's group based in Beverly Hills. They realized they'd gain credibility if they partnered with male scientists and politicians. Slade's mom went straight to the top, to Ari Hagensmith, the pioneering chemist who connected the dots between smog and cars.
My mom was on the phone all the time. I remember that with Dr. Hagensmith. So here she was on the one hand working with the Caltech scientist who really isolated the reasons behind ozone, and on the other hand, bringing her children to demonstrations with gas masks on.
In the end, if the Ladies Who Club hadn't protested in the 1960s or in 1900 for that matter, who knows how dirty the air would have become before we started sweeping it up. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
On Marketplace's PM program today, We Used to Be China tells more of the story of smog and how the U.S. got its act together to fight it. Now, if you have a house in what used to be one of America's hazy blue cities, go into your attic someday and take a look at the soot that might still be in the insulation from the pre-catalytic converter days. new study out of Harvard says cities in the Rust Belt, like South Bend, Indiana, Erie, and Scranton, Pennsylvania, have been, in fact, unhappy. In their boom years, at least, workers were paid high wages, but no longer. Sally Herships looks at how unhappy cities can attract residents.
According to the study, workers in these Rust Belt cities today get cheap housing, which lets you make other choices. New York also registers as an unhappy city. A lot of workers here trade high salaries for happiness.
You say to yourself, all right, I've got this job offer from Goldman Sachs. I know I'm going to be working like 16-hour days. I know I'm never going to see my kid.
Kelly Goldsmith teaches marketing at Northwestern's Kellogg School of Management. She says when it comes to making decisions, we don't make happiness a priority. But she says we're not idiots. We're optimists. Cassie Mogilner teaches marketing at Wharton. She says residents of different cities might report happiness differently.
I actually am from California, where the norm is to talk about all the wonderful things of one's life and to, you know, rose color everything, including their own well-being and happiness.
Mogilner says many decisions people make about where to live, like choosing a job, are made to be happy, not instead of being happy. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
And when business news sounds like an SNL skit, remember the Saturday Night Live parody ad, "All You Need for Valentine's Day is a Trip to CVS," the pharmacy chain? Over the weekend, news broke that Lindt, the fancy chocolate company, is buying Russell Stover. A published report puts the price in the $1.5 billion range. Russell Stover was founded in Denver in 1923 by Russell and Clara Stover. As for Lindt, its full name is Schokoladefabriken Lindt und Sprüngli, and the enterprise goes back to 1845 in Zurich. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.